भक्ताय प्रतिबोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्धतामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेषिणी. From chapter 14, verse 6.
Verse 1?
Verse 6, right?
No, 5.
Oh, 5. Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Jane, do you want to use the book? Chapter 14, verse 5. Sattvam rajastama iti, sattvam rajastama iti, gunah prakriti sambhavaha, gunah prakriti sambhavaha, nibadhanti mahabaho, nibadhanti mahabaho, dehe dehinam avyayam, dehe dehinam avyayam, sattvam rajaha tamaha, iti gunaha prakriti sambhavaha nibhadnanti mahabaho, there's no sandhi there, mahabaho dehe dehinam avyayam. This chapter 14 is really introducing the prakriti, purusha and prakriti, the nature of the prakriti, which we call maya. And then now we're really starting to talk about the three gunas which comprise maya. The three gunas, sometimes they're translated as three strands. It's better just to keep the name guna. If we think of maya, or the prakriti, as that which is responsible for the manifestation of names and forms, or the manifestation of all duality, that maya is viewed as being comprised of three gunas. It's not that there's a maya that has three gunas which are its qualities. It's not that. It's that maya is comprised of these three strands, these three gunas. The first guna is called sattva. The sattva guna is that which reflects consciousness, which allows for that shanti, peace, a peaceful mind is a sattvic mind, a mind in which manifests consciousness, which manifests ananda or wholeness, or that which is light in the world, or in terms of the whole physical world, the whole world that we experience, the sense organs and the mind, both of which reflect consciousness, are said to be made of sattva. Okay, so in this world, the organs of knowledge, which are your sense organs, and the mind, which receives all of the sensory data, is made of sattva. When we say made of, you have to think like this. We're dividing the entire creation, the entire world of our experience, first of all, twofold, into the subject and object. I am the subject. Everything else is the object. What comprises the object is anything that I can enjoy a subject-object relationship with. So that means this world is the prakriti, that which can, the material, which can be objectified, this physical world, which is known through my sense organs. My sense organs are objectified. They're also prakriti. They're also fall into the realm of the object because I can objectify them. I can be aware of them. The mind, I'm aware of the mind, my thoughts, my moods, my emotions. I can objectify them. I can be aware of them. They're also the prakriti. Anything that can be objectified, this world of the object, even the ahankara, I am doing this, I am doing that, I am happy, I am sad, this I notion, this also is objectifiable. Time is objectifiable. Space is objectifiable. So anything that can be relegated to the subject, to the object, even if I'm identified with it as me, as the subject. If I can objectify it, that makes it, in our analysis, an object. And anything that can be objectified, including time and space and everything in it, anything that can be objectified, has for its material cause, in terms of name and form, what we call prakriti, or maya. So what is responsible for the manifestation of all things objectifiable is what we call maya, or prakriti. Why this is important is because usually when we think of things that are objectifiable, we only think of our sensory experience. So whatever I can apply the scientific method to, anything that I can know through my sense organs, this world is objectifiable. So this world would, for most of us, be the prakriti. This is the material world that we experience. We don't consider the mind and the sense organs as part of the world, you know, even though they themselves are objectifiable. We don't consider our thoughts or our moods or our imagination as objectifiable, because when we do the subject-object differentiation, the subject starts here with this body-mind-sense organs as the subject, and everything out here is the object. And so if I say, you know, whatever is objectifiable, your mind will immediately think, okay, everything external to my body is the object. And so then we look at the material cause of the object, and we have maybe the five elements, space, air, fire, water, earth, and the elementals, and that's it. We don't include intelligence or knowership into the material universe that we experience. But actually, the sense organs and the mind are objectifiable also. It's just like, think of it like this, if we're talking about the nature of prakriti, if you have a dream at night, the dream material, what is responsible for the manifestation of the dream, has to include, right, the physical world. It also has to include the energy that allows for motion. It also has to include the living beings that have knowership. Right, so all of that is included in the dream world. And so if you want to talk about, well, what is the material cause of this dream projection? That material cause of the dream projection has to include an intelligence principle, an active principle, and a material principle for solidity, for name and form. You see that? We don't usually do that, or we don't include that when we're talking about the material world. So here, when we're talking about maya, which is responsible for the projection of vision, we have to include the physical world, motion, movement, energy. We have to include subject-object, knowership, knower known, because my mind and sense organs are as much a part of the physical world as the physical world is. You see what I mean? It's as much a part of the world as the things I perceive. The perceiver is as much a part of the world as the perceived. Think of the dream. The dream character, the perceiver, the knower, is as much a part of the dream world as the objects which he or she perceives. That means that you have to account for the consciousness, the manifestation of consciousness or knowership in that dream world, as well as the things that are known. So similar here, you have to account for, in this universe, this manifestation, what we say, this manifest universe, which is, we have to account for all of the different parts of it. And so this is what the sattva, rajas, and tamas of maya represent. The sattva, when we talk about the sattva as part of maya, one of the three strands of maya, one of the gunas, the sattva guna, it is the material cause of everything that reflects consciousness, the sense organs and the mind primarily. And from the standpoint of the whole creation, if you look at the sattva running through the whole creation, it represents the knownness of the entire creation? What allows the entire creation to be known as Ishvara? Just give you another little example to understand this. When you have a dream or an imagination, there's two things happening. There are the jivas, the individuals in the dream that are experiencing the creation through their mind and sense organs, sattva. Okay? But also when you're having a dream, there are times in the dream when you're not identified with a character, and yet the whole dream is known. Sattva. That's the sattva. If I have a thought or imagination, the entire thought is known. If I have a thought, just think about this, you have an imagination, the whole imagination is known. That's because of the sattva of maya is pervasive to the imagination. But in that imagination, okay, in that imagination, say there's a lot of activity. I like you to imagine a meadow that has a lot of activity. It has animals in it, there's people walking around in it, there's trees, there's wind blowing. There's activity in the meadow. The meadow is known, that's sattva, the knownness of the meadow. The activity of the meadow is rajas, the second guna. What is responsible for motion, for activity? That material cause is what we call rajas, that maya part of maya. That prakriti is what we call rajas. Now also, say we have the meadow also has a lot of nama rupa, name and form in it. That is tamas. What allows the stability of a tree, the stability of a blade of grass, the stability of a human being, this physicality of all of these forms that we see, that is the tamas aspect. And so we say this whole, so now let's look at this, that we say the whole creation is a projection of maya, and maya is comprised of these three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas. Okay? And so sattva, now let's look at sattva one more time. As a dreamer, if I'm not identified with any character in the dream, then my experience is just the knownness of the dream, like the knownness of any thought that you have. The knownness of the dream is pervasive. That's because of sattva. You are the Ishvara. You are the Lord of your dream. You're the Ishvara of the dream. The dream is known, though, because of the pervasive sattva. The dream goes into a manifest condition, it's not known at all. The only thing there is conscious being. When the dream is up, because of the pervasiveness of sattva, rajas, and tamas, all pervasive of each other. It's not like there's sattva over here and rajas over here. Okay, so there's sattva, rajas, and tamas, so the whole dream is known, the whole dream is in motion, and the whole dream has nama, rupa, name, and form. So those are the three aspects of maya. Now, these three aspects, sattva, that which reflects consciousness, rajas, that which is the active principle, and tamas, that which is responsible for names and forms or for physicality, are also used to qualify the quality of your mind. Your mind, for instance, we also will see in chapter 14 and 16, but 14 also, some foods are considered sattvic. Some foods are considered rajasic or tamasic. Sattvic foods help for you to have a subtle, quiet, peaceful body and mind. One where conscious being is shining. The ananda or the wholeness of your being shines and reflects in that type of mind. There's a lightness to it, a vibrancy, a tejas. Tejas means kind of a brilliant, a brilliance, a peaceful, calm brilliance to your being, to your state of mind. If your mind is rajasic, there's a lot of raga dvesha in the mind, likes and dislikes. And that type of, when the mind is overwhelmed by likes, your likes and dislikes, it needs to act. Like if you have a longing for something or a desire for something, that will propel you into action. So we say that person's mind is rajasic. Can also be nivritti. I don't like something. That's just the other side of the coin. That rajas will make me go away from things. So the rajas is what's responsible for raga dvesha and what comes, likes and dislikes, and what comes off of that, which can be anxiety and irritation and anger and excitement. All of these things have to do with needing to, longing for something, wanting something, desiring something, either in a positive or negative way. So that's the rajas aspect. The mind that we say, oh, this person is very rajasic. It can also mean, oh, he's very, a person's very, you know, hot-tempered or temperamental, easy to anger, you know. Or on a positive, that person has so much energy, they just never stop. You know, they have so much energy. Or that person is so driven by his desire. This is all rajas, you know. We say that person's very rajasic. You say a person is tamasic, or, you know, overwhelmed by tamas, we would say, that person sleeps all the time. They want to sleep all the time. Or they're just too tired, they can't get themselves to do anything. They may want to do something, but they don't have the energy to do it. You know? Or they don't have the energy or the care to differentiate between dharma and adharma. It doesn't really matter. They don't really think about it. They just kind of slothfully do what they want to do. So, well, if you say a person is really tamasic, that's not a compliment. But you might yourself say, oh, I feel so tamasic. We say that, you know, if you use these language, oh, I feel so tamasic. And what does that mean? I'm just so tired and I just don't want to do anything. I just can't even move. I just don't care about anything. So that's a mood. Overwhelmed by tamas. Rajas, you're overwhelmed, you're driven by a desire or by an attachment. You know, and you really want that thing. You have energy to pursue it and you want it. Or you have the irritation of not being able to get your way. And you might say about yourself, I just feel so rajasic. Then you can mean, I'm just so restless. I feel restless. I can't just sit with myself and relax. My mind is just whirling around. I feel so rajasic. People talk like that. And we'll see in the Gita in this chapter that they're using terms like this. And when you feel sattvic, you enjoy just being. You enjoy gaining knowledge. Yeah. You enjoy studying. You enjoy nature. You enjoy just being with yourself. You're not driven by rajas, and you also are not slothful. So your mind enjoys kind of a naturally meditative state, a naturally bright state, a natural state of feeling all is well with me. So you might say, my mind is so sattvic, I wish it was always like this. So Swamiji makes fun of us starting to use these kind of terms. It just adds one dimension upon already all these identifications. But it's good for us to really understand that what we're talking about all derives from Maya, which is the cause for the manifestation of the whole creation. If you think of the whole creation as a manifestation of infinite knowledge, kind of like your imagination, you know, is a manifestation of your knowledge. A dream also, in a sense, is a manifestation of knowledge. Right? Going from unmanifest to manifest, we look at the whole creation as Ishvara, as the Lord. Lord and God doesn't really equate to Jewish God or to Christian, or, you know, the Judeo-Christian in Islam. It doesn't really equate. It's an Eastern idea, so we have to kind of re-understand it. So it's not good to use the word God, because everybody has their definition of it. So here, when we say Ishvara, think of it like this. If that Maya, I have this little bit of Maya available to me, that from my being, the conscious being that I am, I can imagine a meadow, I can imagine an ocean, I can imagine my vision of a universe. I can imagine. And that material that allows for that imagination is what we call Maya. It's a very powerful material. But this material has no being apart from me. Right? So Maya is something that is there at my disposal, But it doesn't cover me, it doesn't change me, it doesn't modify me. It comes from me, is sustained by me, and goes back into me. But before, during, and after its manifestation, nothing happens to me. So conscious being remains exactly the same, but it has this creative capacity that we call Maya. We see that on an individual level, but now when we talk about Maya on the infinite level, that Maya is, has for its base conscious being, which is my own being, but non-objectifiable subject, and that total Maya is what is responsible for the manifestation of the whole creation. And in that whole creation, all of us are a part of it. Just like if you were to have a whole in your imagination or your dream, you have that imagination, and then there's many characters in the dream. They're all part of that imagination. They all are made of the same Maya, right? They're warp and woof. If you have an imagination, everything in it, all of the jivas, all of the individuals in it, they're all part of that imagination, right? But some parts of the imagination can see and hear and experience, and others can't. What allows for seeing or hearing or thinking in the imagination is sattva. What allows for all of the activity is rajas. What allows for the names and forms is tamas. Okay? But so if we think of Ishvara, here's this infinite, as though imagination, we say infinite knowledge, in which all of us are included. And each one of us has a little piece of Maya ourselves, in terms of having a mind that can imagine. A mind that can imagine, a mind that can project. So we can understand, you know, the relationship of Maya to your being. We have to cross over into understanding it on an infinite level, where this body, mind, sense organs is part of an infinite manifestation of knowledge. But you can understand what that is. Maybe you can't have a vision of it as an infinite manifestation, but you can understand what it is in reference to your being. What is this Maya capacity in reference to the conscious being that you are? It is an incredible capacity to be able to imagine, to be able to think, to be able to dream. All of these things are because of this capacity of Maya. What you want to look at is the relationship of conscious being of me to that capacity, and see how when I imagine, as I imagine, nothing happens to me. I need viveka, but you have that viveka. Viveka means discrimination. You have that viveka available to you. If you imagine, you can recognize your own presence and differentiate it from the imagination that comes and goes. That's viveka. Now I have to be able to recognize my own presence in reference to the Maya that makes up this whole creation, the whole creation, in which this body, mind, sense organs are included in that Maya. All the body, mind, sense organs, all objectifiable. But I have to, it helps me to understand this objectifying if I understand sattva, rajas, and tamas. Because that allows you to objectify as part of Maya your sense organs and your mind, your moods, your emotions, your thoughts, your I thought, and to objectify all of the activity, and to objectify all of the names and forms as part of one entity that we call Maya, and differentiate that from me that is ultimately the subject. Okay? So here. Now, in this verse, so what does he say? He says, sattva, rajas, and tamas. For verse 5, sattva, rajas, and tamas, iti, gunaha. These are the three gunas. Sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattva, rajas, tamas, iti, thus, gunaha, the gunas. These are the gunas. Prakriti, sambhavaha. These gunas all originate in the prakriti. They come from the prakriti. They actually have their being in the prakriti. You can't, don't think like this, that they are born from prakriti as though prakriti is a substance that has the gunas as qualities. It's these gunas come into manifestation as the prakriti comes into manifestation. When all of the gunas are in unmanifest condition, we call that prakriti. The three gunas that make up prakriti are in unmanifest condition, we say that's the prakriti. in which the three gunas are in what we call samavastha. They're, all of the three gunas are in a state of equilibrium. These gunas come into manifestation. The thing to understand here is that the prakriti is sattva, rajas, and tamas. Prakriti comes into manifestation. Three gunas are up, goes into uncausal condition. Three gunas are in causal condition. So now what he says, these three gunas which are the prakriti, he says, nipadnanti, hey Mahabaho, he addresses Arjuna and the Vokata. These bind, nibadnanti. They bind, and the ni is like nishtya. Bund means to bind. They bind very firmly, very strongly. The dehi, the one who has a body, the indweller in the body, the dehi, who is avyayam. Avyayam means itself immutable. They bind me, the one indwelling in this body. Dehe means in the body. The one, the dehi, the one indwelling, dehe, in the body, who is avyayam. Avyayam means changeless. This conscious being that I am, right, is now from the standpoint of this body, I'm abiding in this body, from the standpoint of the body, right? And I myself am changeless, immutable. Avyayam means my being never wavers. Just like if you have an imagination, your being doesn't waver at all. Nothing happens to you at all. But from the standpoint, so here, it's exactly the same. Yourself, when you say me, this conscious being that I am, you never change. You always are abiding, you're always untouched, you're always free. But from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, the mind itself says, you know, I am, right? I am the conscious being. I am happy. I am sattvic. I am rajasic. I am tamasic. I take on all of the qualities of the gunas to myself. You know, I am slothful. I am tired. You know, I am fat. That's tamasic, right? I have so much energy. That's rajasic. You know, my mind is meditative. That's sattva. I'm continually identifying my being, which is avyayam, which is changeless, with all of these qualities that are being experienced. Prakriti, whatever is the material cause, means whatever can be objectified, is experienced. It is the object to me, the subject. Prakriti is experienced. I'm aware of it. It is illumined by consciousness. But it binds me, because I take myself to be it. Who's the I there? The mind that is can't differentiate, the mind which can't differentiate me, the conscious being which is itself, from the experiences, the objectifiable experiences that it's having. It takes me to be the experience that comes and goes. So I take myself to be the moods that comes and goes, the attitudes that come and go. I take myself to be the body, the mind, the sense organs. The body is made of tamas. The prana is made of rajas. The mind itself and the sense organs are made of sattva. And then all of the qualities that they have, like the sattva, the mind made of sattva is being overwhelmed by rajas. But then what do I say? Oh, I'm so nervous, or I'm so restless. So all of these become points of identification. So what he says here is these three gunas that are the prakriti, they bind the self. They bind the self, which is really changeless, right? Abiding in this body, the dehi abiding in this body. Shankara makes this clear, this verse clear. They as though bind the self. They as though bind the self because of your identification with those experiences. There's no bondage for yourself. Bondage is just is really just ajnanam. It's just self-ignorance. There is no real bondage for the self. If there is real bondage for your being, you can get rid of it. You'd be as real as your being is real. But the bondage that you feel It's because if lack of viveka or discrimination stops you from being able to recognize your own self, the self, the changeless self, the dehi, amidst all this changing phenomena. We're always viewing ourselves from the standpoint or the lens of the changing phenomena. I'm viewing myself through that. I'm never recognizing myself as the platform in which all of these things are rising and setting. See that? It's a totally different vision. My ahankara, my I notion, is placed in the thing that I'm experiencing. Right? If it's placed in the thing that I'm actually aware of and experiencing, then I can only view myself from the standpoint of that experience. So say my mind is sad. The mind is sad. I illumine the sadness. I'm aware of the sadness. The sadness comes and goes. We don't think like that. We don't notice that. That's a fact, but we don't notice it. What the mind notices is the sadness which I am. That's the what we call anyonya adyasa. That's the superimposition. The sadness is experienced. I experience myself through the lens of that sad emotion. Or I'm ecstatically happy. Now I'm experiencing myself through the lens of that experience. It defines me. It actually, it's more than defining me. I totally identify with the experience. I don't notice a little bit of logic and a little bit of logic. Look, viewing your experience logically, you would have to realize that, well, actually, these experiences come and go in me. I'm the stable one. And I have an experience that the experience comes, it's there, and it goes. I remain. So actually, I'm avyayam. I'm not changing at all. The experiences are changing. But what if your identification is only with the experience, right? Then I am the experience. Sadness, I am sad. Happiness, I am happy. Agitation, I am agitated. And that's what we call the ahankara, this I notion, continually identifying with the changing experiences. But to be able to stop that, we need viveka. We need to be able to discriminate between me, the subject, and the object. We're used to drawing the line between subject and object here at this body. This is the subject, this is the object. We're saying, no, actually, this also is an object. It functions as a subject, but it is an object through my 5 sense organs. It is an object. My sense organs function as a subject, but they're also an object. They're known by my mind. You know if your sense organs are working or not. They're also an object. The mind functions as the subject, but actually it's also an object. Because I'm aware of every thought that I have, of every emotion I have, of every feeling I have. The I thought functions as a subject, but it's also an object. I'm aware of the thought. And I don't walk around saying I all the time. Right? And so we need to go through this process of viveka, of discrimination, so that I can land on myself. So that now when you say I, the word I, it lands on the true subject, not the subject that can be objectified. Because if something can be objectified, then who's the one that is the subject of that objectification? And so in the end, your point of identity has to change. From the body, you recognize that the body isn't also objectifiable, so it's not ultimately me. Sense organs are objectifiable. They're also not ultimately me. Mind is objectifiable. It's not ultimately me. To get to me, I have to get to the conscious being that is not objectifiable. Consciousness is not objectifiable. You can't have consciousness of consciousness as though there's two things there. The conscious being that you are is self-evident. And so that is ultimately the subject. There's nothing behind it. There's not a consciousness behind consciousness. There's not an existence behind existence. There's conscious being, which is ultimately who I am. Mm. And so everything else is objectifiable, is maya, is Maya, is Prakriti, and what are the components of Maya? Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. Okay. So now, having saying that the Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas is what is binding me as though, then he goes on, so verse number 6. Tetrasattvam nirmalatvat, tetrasattvam nirmalatvat, prakashakamanamayam, prakashakamanamayam, sukasangena badnati, sukasangena badnati, jnanasangena chanaka, jnanasangena chanaka, tetra sattvam nirmalatvat, prakashakam anamayam, sukasangena badnati, jnanasangena cha anagha. He says there, in reference to these three here, in reference to the three gunas, the sattva, nirmalatvat, because of being pure of any impurities, mala means an impurity, it's without impurities. So this sattva, because of its purity, prakashakam, it shines, it is luminous, and anamayam, it's free of any type of affliction, because there's no impurity there. So it's free of affliction, it's free of sin, it's free of any type of affliction. Sometimes they translate it as sin. Anyway, here it's just affliction. So this sattva, because of its purity, because of being pure, is self-luminous, okay? It's luminous, it shines, free of affliction. And he says, it binds, this sattva, it binds through one's attachment to sukha, sukha sangha. One is attached to sukha, right? If I have my mind, and my mind has all kinds of emotions and feelings in it, which ones do I like? Which ones am I attached to? I want the happy thoughts. I want the thoughts that have peace, that have shanti, that have sukha, that are pleasurable to have. There's many types of pleasurable thoughts, but all pleasurable thoughts fall under the category of sukha. The other many types of unpleasurable thoughts fall under the category of dukkha, like agitation, or anger, or hatred, or jealousy, or hurt feelings, all of these, sadness. All of these are thoughts which I don't choose. I don't choose these thoughts. Somebody says to you, well, do you want to be sad or happy? You know, do you want to be peaceful or agitated? You know, do you want to be compassionate or bitter? Which one would you choose? If you chose one like the dark ones, either there's something wrong with you, or you're choosing it. You're making a choice to experience those things so that you can become big enough to have ananda or fullness in spite of them. Sometimes we make choices for hardship, to experience hardship, you know, but we do it for the sake of our shanti, the sake of our growth. So whatever your choices are making, even if you're choosing, like in psychology, you know, if you're in therapy or something, we go into the things that hurt us. Why? Not so we can stay there, but so we can transform. So we can transform those things so that my mind has a platform that is stable and whole and complete and can handle all of the ups and downs of the world. We're choosing sukha. So now, for samsari, when you have a sukha vritti, a thought modification that is happy, that's what I want. Now what we'll say is, as a samsari, you don't have any self-knowledge, you don't know what the source of the ananda is, then you'll say, I'm so happy because of you. I'm happy because of this situation. I'm happy because of this particular gain. You know? So the happiness, the sukha that I'm experiencing, experiencing is always conditional. It's always because of something. And so I'm attached to the sukha, but now I'm attached to the source of the sukha. Just think about it. I'm attached to the sukha, the happiness. Means what? I love happiness. Okay. But you can love happiness. You don't. What's the attachment about it? The attachment is to the source of the happiness. Now, say you're a jnani, you have self-knowledge. Oh, I love sukha, I love my happiness. I love these happy vrittis, these happy thoughts. You know? What is the source? My own being. Right? That's freedom. When I'm the source of the happiness, then I can just relax there because the self is there, it never goes away, it never changes. So once I recognize that myself as the very source of ananda, then the happiness is a natural condition for my mind because the mind is never away from that ananda. And so if I'm the source, there's no problem. The problem is when I'm not the source, when I think that the ananda is out here somewhere, and then I'm attached to that object to give me the sukha vritti, which I prefer over the dukkha vritti, the sorrowful vritti. Vritti means thought modification. So say over here, this person over here is giving me sorrow, you know, giving me problems. And so now what do I want to do? What? I want them to go away or I want to go away. I want that situation to resolve. I don't want the situation to stay as it is. Somehow it has to resolve. In some senses, we could say the more mature we get in terms of having figured out how life works, the resolution, really just still within samsara, has come more and more with my ability to let go of whatever reasons it is that that person is able to get under my skin, or that situation is able to cause me grief, right? And I figure that out over time, even within samsara. But until I figure that out, then that person is responsible for my sorrow. And that brings up all kinds of dislikes and hatreds and wanting to get rid of them and all this type of, all of the negative gamut of emotions. Mm. So here, what they say, the sattva, that sattva vritti where the mind is peaceful, I am attached to that. I want that. Yeah. And I'm also, he says, so that becomes what binds me, is the attachment to that particular type of vritti, which I have to produce. See, unless you know that the source of that is your being, which is changeless, never goes anywhere, that sukha has to be produced and maintained. And also I'm attached to knowledge, the gain of knowledge. Mm. Because knowledge also takes place in a shanta vritti. So these are the attachments. You know, for a person who's sattvic, you can have a love for study, a love for learning. You know, that's jnana, a love for knowledge. That's all sattvic. So we say, well, they'll probably bring this up because, you know, the Brahmins are really the scholars in India. That's supposed to be sattva guna. So the sattva guna is very related to knowledge and your love of learning. That love of learning, that also creates an attachment. So this is the way that the sattva attaches, through sukha and through knowledge. Let's do one more. Rajo ragatmakam vidhi, Trishna sanga sumudbhavam. Krishna sanga samudbhavam tanipadnati kaunteya karma sangena dehinam rajo rajatmakam vidhi Krishna asanga samudbhavam tanipadnati kaunteya karma sangena dehinam. This is the second guna. He says, Rajaha rajatmakam vidhi. May you know this rajas to be raga. Raga means raga dvesha. Raga means your likes and dislikes, these things that impel you into action. Swamiji has a nice commentary on this where he says, raga also means coloring something like a dye. If you have a white cloth and you dye it red, you know, that's raga. You've colored it. So raga, we look at raga as something that colors the mind in terms of its desire, in terms of its longing, in terms of its attachment. And so what Swamiji says here is that once this raga, this desire or longing arises in the mind, Trishna arises in the mind, it's hard to get rid of it. Just like if you dye a white cloth red, it's pretty hard to get the white back, right? And so raga, the desires that catch hold of you, real desires that catch hold of you, those are hard to dismiss once they've taken root in you. And so he says, may you know, viddhi, may you know this raja. This rajas is really in the form of raga dvesha, your likes and dislikes. And they are trishna asanga samudbhavam. It brings about trishna. Raga dvesha, the likes and dislikes, bring about trishna. Trishna is longing, the longing for something, the desire for something. Swamiji often uses the word longing instead of desire, because longing, I can understand, using the word longing, you can relate to the force of it.
It's more longing, real, more
yeah,
real.
There's a longing for it. And then the asakti, trishna asakti, asakti is that tremendous attachment. You long for something, and then when you get it, you need it. There's an asakti there. Your well-being depends on it. Especially you find that in relationships, in any type of any relationship where there's a deep attachment. You know, that attachment is in the form of, I can't be without it. I really need that to be happy. I have it, but I need to keep it to be happy. That's asakti. Trishna is the longing to get it. So this rajas, really starts with raga, the likes and dislikes, which move into trishna, the longing for it, and the attachment that comes from it. And he says that rajas, it binds the person, how? Karma sangini. It binds the dehi, one who's indwelling in the body. Through the attachment to karma. You're attached to karma, because once that longing is there, that asakti is there, you have to act. You're not free to just be. You're not free to let things come and go. You're bound now to do something. To do something to gain, or to do something to get rid of, or to do something to maintain. There's no just simple abiding once the rajas or the raga takes place. So that's interesting to really contemplate on these things in reference to your own mind and the difference between when your mind isn't being taken over by rajas, and it's just there, etc. At that time, there is no desire to, it's not about doing something. Your mind is free to just abide, and you enjoy that abiding. The abiding of the sattva can be overwhelmed by the rajas as you start longing for more and wanting to keep. So these things, these sattva and rajas and tamas, are playing off of each other all the time. Sometimes the sattva is rising to the holding the most energy. Sometimes rajas is rising to the top. Sometimes tamas is rising to the top, so they're all moving like this. Sometimes, as you start to kind of understand the world in these terms, you can see that the mind is overwhelmed by tamas, the mind is overwhelmed by rajas, the mind is over sattva. You see it more as prakriti. All of the moods and everything that are passing through, the situations that are passing through, you can see them in terms of prakriti, of maya. In terms of sattva, rajas, and tamas. Okay. So. Okay, we're going to do one more, 5 minutes. You can do
really?
It. Okay. Yeah. Because I want to be all three. It'll only take a minute.
Maybe we can review.
Then you can relax. Then you can... Tamas twajnana jamdhiddi. Tamas twajnana jamdhiddi. Mohanam sarvadehinam.
Mohanam sarvadehinam.
Pramadalasya nidrabihi. Pramadalasya nidrabihi. Tannipadnati bharata. Tannipadnati bharata. Tamaha tu ajnanajam viddhi. Mohanam sarvadehinam. Pramada alasya nidrabihi. Tannipadnati bharata. He says, know that tamas, viddhi, may you know that tamas is born of ajnanam, of ignorance. But here what he means, not the mula vidya of self-ignorance, it's the ignorance of dharma, of what is dharma adharma. Having no viveka, no discrimination about what is appropriate behavior or inappropriate behavior, nor any care. This first he says, This tamas, know that it's born of ajnanam, where there's no lack of viveka. And it's something that mohanam is, deludes sarvadehinam, all of those that, all the dehis, all of those who have a body. This tamas is there, this delusion is there. This also, you know, confusion about dharma adharma. But he says, well, when tamas is up, it's like that. When the tamas is up, it causes delusion, it causes confusion, you know. There's no viveka between what is appropriate, what is inappropriate. He says, it binds by its pramada, alasya, and nidra. Pramada is, in a sense, it's an indifference or a laziness. It's a, we'd say like an indifference, a lack of care or a lack of alertness to what is appropriate behavior in a situation. That's pramada. Alasya is a slothfulness or a laziness, or just simply not caring one way or the other, because you don't have the energy. And nidra is sleep. So sleep is the most tamasic is sleep. I don't care, let me just sleep. Alasya is I'm too tired to bother. And pramada is I don't care. So they're all filled with, I don't care, I don't want to deal, I'm tired, I just want to sleep, leave me alone, let me just do what I want to do. You know, if I just want to have my drink, that's all. I just want to be stoned. Don't tell me if it's right or wrong. I really don't care. That's Thomas. So, you know, there's no question of dharma or adharma. But, you know, to understand it, there's no care about dharma or adharma or what is appropriate energy, what is appropriate behavior. But also there's no energy for that care. That's a slothfulness. There's just no energy, you know. That's why there's an inertness about tamas. You know, when we say the demons, if we talk about the demons, the devas, the devatas and the demons in all the mythology, the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, there are two types of demons. One are the rakshasas. The rakshasas are ruled by rajas. They're very aggressive, they're very assertive, they're greedy. They know what they want and they go after it. They don't care about, if the sattva is totally subsumed, they just go after what they want with a lot of energy. Those are the rakshasas. Ravana was a great rakshasa. The asuras are ruled by tamas, you know. They also could care less about anything. They could care less about dharma. They just want their food and their drink and their sleep. They don't care about anything. So they're considered to be the asuras. They're very dull. Rakshasas have more energy. So the rakshasas and the asuras, tamas and rajas, you know, overwhelmed by tamas and rajas, you know, with very little sattva happening there, are considered the demons, where the devatas are considered predominantly sattva. They're ruled by sattva. The sattva is what reflects, you know, which reflects conscious being, which reflects ananda, which enjoys shanti, which is a buddhi, which is illumined by knowledge. That's sattva. So those are the devatas. It's the good guys, okay? The devatas. And then the rakshasas and the asuras are not really awake to dharma, or not in a place to enjoy their own fullness. Right? And so then they become, you know, grasping and greedy and, you know, searching for power and all of these type of things. These are all manifestations of sattva, rajas, and tamas. And this sattva, rajas, and tamas is flowing through us also. And we can be predominantly sattva, or predominantly rajas, or predominantly tamas, depending on which one is we're spending the most time the most time in. What condition are we spending the most time in? But say you're just totally a tamasic person. Come from a tamasic family, you live in a tamasic culture, you're a tamasic person. But even a person who's overwhelmed by tamas will sometimes have a lot of rajas and sometimes have sattva. And a person's overwhelmed by primarily rajas will sometimes be tamasic and sometimes be sattva. Because all three are there. It's just what is dominant. You know, what is dominant? Like this is, in terms of a material, this is tamas. In terms of the physicality, this as a material, this is tamas. You know? But it's illumined, it enjoys knownness. That's its relationship with sattva. It enjoys knownness. The atoms are moving, that's rajas. Right? But this is definitely primarily tamas. This doesn't become a knower at all, ever. Right? But the thing is, it is known. It is known. So anyway, that's as Ishwara and Ishwara, it is known. Anyway, that's going a little bit far, but let's stop here, because I could keep going, but I'm not get too tired. Let's stop here and we'll take kind of into another section. That's where I want to finish these four verses. We're going to be in sattva, rajas, and tamas for another probably 10 verses or so. So might as well get used to the concepts.
Purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vasishyate. Om shanti shanti shanti. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
Yeah.
You talked a lot about how, well, here's an example. Anything that can be objectified has property as its material cause. And then there's
material cause. There's another material cause too, right?
Oh, okay. Well, there's another thing that gets said not as frequently, and I've noticed just not only tonight but on other times. Conscious being is, well, I'm going to say me, and everything else is maya or property.
Yeah.
So is property the material cause of everything else, or is it everything else, or is it somehow both?
And it's both.
If it's both, why call it material cause sometimes, and sometimes say it's everything else? What's that all?
Well, it's not everything else. If I don't say I would never say Maya is the material cause and everything else, but I might say everything else other than the subject is Maya.
That's okay.
So if I say everything other than the subject is Maya, or using Prakriti as a synonym. So say everything other than consciousness is Maya. That means everything that exists within time and space, everything that's objectifiable, So once I say other than the subject, we mean everything that can be objectified. That is Maya. Anything that exists within time and space, anything that can be objectified is Maya. Consciousness can't be objectified. There's not a subject-object relationship of consciousness aware of consciousness as though there's two things. Consciousness is self-evident. There's not a subject-object relationship within conscious being itself. But in terms of this creation that we experience, we start doing this subject-object differentiation by recognizing what is it that's known to me, where I can make that differentiation. And normally, we only do that from the physical body on out. Subject, object. I'm the subject, you're the object. But we have to realize that the sense organs that are aware of this world of objects are aware of this body. Same five sense organs that allow me to know you allow me to know this body. The mind, the sense organs that also are known, that's how you know if you're seeing well or you're blind or you're hearing or you're deaf, you know, you're aware of your sense organs through the mind. So they're also objectifiable. The subject moves inward as though. And so eventually you get to the subject which cannot move inward any further. It's non, that's what we mean, non-objectifiable. You can't, there's no one behind it. Whereas with the body, there's somebody illumining it. We don't think about it, but it's the sense organs are illumining it. Without the sense organs, you wouldn't be aware of your body. The mind uses and illumines the sense organs. Without the mind, your sense organs don't function. Like, for instance, if you are daydreaming, your sense organs are all here, and the instruments are here, but nothing's happening because you're daydreaming. So the mind is required to know, to use the sense organs. So now the subject has moved inward again. But then we recognize, well, the mind is also known. All the thoughts are known. All the emotions are known. They're also objectified. Mm-hmm. Right? So now we've moved inward again to the subject because of whom these are all aware. Then you get to the I thought. Well, the I thought is also known. Then you get to your knowledges, your ignorances. Those are also known. Then you get to the roles in life, like I'm a mother or a daughter or a sister or a brother or whatever. Those are also objectified. You get to time and space. Those are also objectifiable. And you're left finally just with your being, consciousness. And now is that objectifiable? I say, no, it's not.
Because but it's known. It's known.
It's known because it's self-evident. Consciousness is consciousness. That is the very nature of consciousness. There's not a subject-object relationship there, but knowingness is its nature, not knowingness of anything, but just self-evident consciousness. That's the bottom line of you, because that's ultimately the subject. Now, anything that can be objectified is Maya. And we say Maya is the material cause. We use, remember this technical term, for some of you don't bother with this, but upadana-karanam. Upadana-karanam means material cause. Maya is what we call the parinama-upadana-karanam. It's the material cause responsible for all modification, the modifications of the creation, the manifestation of the creation. That's Maya, parinama-upadana-karanam. Brahman, the self, pure conscious being, is called vivarta upadana karanam. So we've got parinama upadana karanam, vivarta upadana karanam. Vivarta means the upadana karanam, the material cause that doesn't go through any modification, any change whatsoever to become the object. So we would say here the material cause of this creation, the substance that is actually here, is conscious being. There is nothing in this creation that is away from conscious being. And all the parinamas, all of the things in the creation that modify, actually you can't find any substance in them themselves. The names and forms break into smaller names and forms infinitely. You can't find a substance. The substance is the vivarta upadana karanam, which is the consciousness, the conscious being which everything enjoys. That's the bottom line of every experience.
So the way that property slash maya is a material cause is that it's a parinama.
Upadanaka, responsible for the manifestation of name and form.
And
manifestation of this duality.
And in a sense that by saying it's responsible for it, it's like the reverse of when we break down name and form into you know, smaller and smaller pieces. It's sort of the build-up. I'm just trying to figure out what...
No, it's...
What does that mean?
Well, when we say responsible for, it means just caught the cause. It's...
I mean, it is the name and form, right?
And
it's also the cause.
Yes, and it is the name and form that goes into unmanifest condition also. Like, okay, for instance, like right now, if I ask you to think of a pine tree, you weren't thinking of a pine tree before, but the pine tree was abiding there in unmanifest condition. It's what we call avyekta. So the whole universe comes in and out of avyekta, unmanifest condition. That unmanifest condition, though, is the prakriti that goes, that is unmanifest and then becomes manifest. Goes unmanifest, becomes manifest.
Say that again, the unmanifest condition is what?
It's prakriti. Prakriti and unmanifest condition that manifests as this universe, but it's the prakriti that goes through manifestation and goes into causal condition.
So it's causal, the way in which it is a cause is when it's unmanifest. And then when it becomes manifest, it's still prakriti, but it's...
It's that causal condition has come into manifestation.
Okay.
Well, just think of it like this. If you think of a pine tree, you weren't thinking of it before.
Mm-hmm.
But it exists, right? It has a causal condition. Because I can ask you to think of it.
Oh, you mean it existed before I thought of it? Is that
yeah.
What you're saying? Okay.
Yeah, it's there in your psyche.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there in unmanifest condition. So say the whole universe is there in unmanifest condition, then it becomes manifest. Then it goes into unmanifest condition. What if right now, okay, I ask you to think of a universe. Yeah. Now, whatever that you have inside is going to now come into manifest condition. That's a big thought as opposed to, you know, so you have a big thought that universe comes into manifest condition. And then it goes into unmanifest condition. But everything that was there in the manifest condition was in unmanifest condition before you brought it up, or you wouldn't be able to bring it up. It's not coming from nothing. It's coming from a causal condition.
Yeah, okay.
You get it? So take that in absolute knowledge. Goes into, we say this universe is like absolute knowledge that comes from an unmanifest condition to a manifest condition to an unmanifest to a manifest.
So Maya, is Maya always there then? As like Brahman?
Yeah, Maya is always there, but it can't be categorized as being something, having any type of substance or being other than Brahman. But it's always there. In unmanifest condition or manifest condition. Why we say Advaita, that it's non-dual, is because there's only one being. Maya doesn't have a separate being. You know, it doesn't have a separate self. It's like, you have to, this would be not a clay pot, for instance. A clay pot is non-dual. There's not a pot and clay, right? There's only clay. But there's a pot. But there's only clay. So what is the pot? We say the pot is mithya. It has no independent reality apart from the clay. It's mithya. We say maya is mithya. That's its order of reality. It has no separate being apart from consciousness.
With the three energies in maya... So we all, you know, we have
such
all...
Such resistance.
What's that? The goodness?
The goodness.
Yeah, and not only that we have all three energies, I think we also need all three energies, don't we? At least Rajas and Tamas, I mean, for example, to go to bed, you need to be sleepy to actually...
We need all three are Maya.
Yeah.
Right? There's nothing apart from it. And so the whole creation is made of sattva, rajas, and tamas. So it's not even a question of need, it's a question of what is.
It's just of what is.
Yeah. And it's there on every level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Say a little bit more, how is it there on every level?
Well, physical, like this physical world,
mm-hmm.
the whole world is in motion. Right? And so, and the whole, from Ishvara's standpoint, the whole world is known. There's also things that are luminous, like the sun. Those are considered to be sattva,
mm-hmm.
In one sense. Really, when we're looking at, we do that kind of metaphorically sometimes. But so we say the whole physical world is in motion. So there's the rajas, and then there's the tamas, the nama-rupa. That the whole thing is known is the sattva, the Ishvara. Okay? Then, for every jiva within the world, there's the tamas of the body, the sense organs in the mind are the sattva, and then the prana, and then the karmendriyas, organs of action, and the prana, is the rajas. Plant, you take any given thing.
Everything.
Okay. And if itself doesn't have a sukshma sharira, a subtle body, then that's its knownness, the sattva, is from the standpoint of Ishvara.
Mm.
It's known to Ishvara. It doesn't have a subtle body itself for it to know itself.
Like the land.
Like the land.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you can see just where the rajas, how absolutely pervasive rajas is. There's nothing that's not in continual motion.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have this all this continual motion, but then there's also tamas, the name and form, the stability of name and form. Even this is filled with rajas from an atomic level. I mean, there's this continual motion here, but it's also tamas. Right? So everything is like that.
But is it sattvic also?
Not from its own standpoint. From its own standpoint, to be sattvic from its own standpoint, you need a sukshma sharira, a subtle body. When we're looking at Vedantically, if you get into Sankhya, the Sankhya Yoga, they'll look at sattva also in terms of things in the world, like the sun, like anything that rises up.
Could be a lotus flower.
Could be like, well, I don't know, maybe, but it would be things that, happy experiences, happy thoughts in your mind, things that are light, like fire. You know how fire goes up?
Mm-hmm.
That would be sattvic. And so they go into different type of explanations like that. We do in a way too, like, well, I don't remember what they are exactly, but we'll see when we get into the Gita, some foods are considered sattvic foods.
Mm-hmm. Or are we going to get into that more later?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in this chapter. There's sattvic foods, there are rajasic foods, there's tamasic foods.
How can time be tamasic?
Time would be, I don't know that time would be tamasic.
So it's just one thing, it's only rajasic?
I don't think that it would be rajasic either. That's a very interesting question, though. Change, because there's change, there's time. But I don't know that there's time without consciousness of change. So that becomes kind of a philosophical question. Without change, there can't be time. But what gives time to us, the concept of time, is the marking of change. You know, otherwise, you have to just say time is change. But when we talk about like the passing of time, there is somebody marking it. You know. Otherwise, you would say that time is just a synonym of change, and we don't really say that. So time requires a conscious relationship with change. And then we talk about the relativity of time. Like, for instance, if you're waiting at a bus stop with nothing to do, 5 minutes is a long time. You know? If you're talking to somebody, having a dynamic conversation, or with your loved one or something, it's unnoticeable. It goes so fast. So there's consciousness involved in the marking of change.
Well, if the three gunas are binding,
yeah.
Wouldn't it be better if it's still to be sattvic?
We'd rather be sattvic, most people would.
Yeah. Even though it's binding.
They're still, yeah, but a person who lives a dharmic life you know, has a much more relative shanti than a person who lives a dharmic, an adharmic life, but it's still relative. So of that's,
see, that's
you,
what's still
yeah, you know, the Vedas, the first part of the Vedas, are viewed kind of as a manual for how to survive in this universe with the greatest amount of relative shanti. But it's still relative. The only thing that's not relative is Brahman, is conscious, is yourself, the your real self, the self that you really are. That is an infinite, changeless, non-relative shanti. Yeah.
Is there only one self?
Mm-hmm.
For all one?
Only one self. The self that is
me.
You
can't really objectify yourself.
Yeah, you can't objectify yourself, so there's only one. Not an object.
I can't even objectify your subject.
Yeah, you can't objectify yourself. I can't objectify myself. So there's no possibility of the self that can't be objectified existing in duality for there to be two. Because if the self could be objectified, then there could be many of them, right? But if it can't be objectified, then there's only one. So the self that I am is the self that you are, is the self that Ishwar is the self that is the self of the universe. But we, of course, through the gunas or through the maya, with this maya upadi, this body, mind, sense organs, the mind is only viewing me through from its own standpoint, because the mind always enjoys conscious being, so it just says, I am the conscious being. There's no viveka or discrimination there. No, go ahead, Igor.
I'm curious about when you were talking, you were saying maya and prakriti being, I think...
Synonyms.
Synonyms. And I wonder if Purusha, what's in the Sankhya?
In the Sankhya, the Purusha would be the Atma, the Atma which is Brahman.
Oh, it would be the Atma?
Yeah, but remember that Sankhya uses Purusha and Prakriti differently, because Sankhya will say the Purusha, which it defines as same as we define the Atma, which is Brahman, as limitless conscious being. But it says there are many of them.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
Prakriti made of sattva, rajas, and tamas. But for Sankhya, Prakriti, which is made of sattva, rajas, and tamas and goes through the same process of creation from unmanifest to manifest, it says it is a real substance in and of itself, and there are many infinite number of purushas which are also real. So Sankhya Yoga is completely dualistic. It's as dual as you can get. It's as dualistic as you can get. Whereas for Vedanta, we use the term Purusha and Prakriti, but Purusha is Brahman, is conscious being, the one Purusha. There is one Purusha, there is one conscious being that we call Brahman. Purusha really means a person. There's one person here, right? There's one Purusha, one conscious being. And this maya that we also call prakriti is made of sattva, rajas, and tamas, but it is mitya. Its order of reality is mitya. It has no separate being. For prakriti, in the Sankhya, prakriti is a separate existent entity, and the purushas are all separate existent conscious, infinite conscious beings. But for Vedanta, no, not at all. There's one conscious being that is the Purusha, and one Prakriti, which is Maya, Mitya, has no being apart from the Purusha.
It makes me think, I don't know much, you know, in qualified dualism, there is the acknowledged
Vishishta
Atman, I think. They acknowledge many Atmans, and one Brahman, is that correct?
In Vishishta Advaita?
Yes.
I'm not sure. I can't talk about it because I don't have enough knowledge about
it.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, so saying that, you're saying that Purusha is Atman, right?
And yes, it's Brahman. Purusha is Brahman, the Atma which is Brahman. There's only Atma is Brahman. The whole teaching of Vedanta is that the Atma is Brahman.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But in Samkhya, Purusha being Atman, there are many Atman.
Yeah.
So it's not
Brahman.
There
is no Brahman.
So there is no Brahman.
No.
Oh, I understand.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
There is no Brahman.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. You know, with the Vishishta Advaita, I think you're right there. I have to look it up, though. I haven't studied Vishishta for a long time, but it is something like what you say.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now that conscious being is the cause for creation, right?
Conscious beings, Brahman,
yeah,
is really not the cause of creation, it's the reality. It's the changeless reality, which is the very self of creation. But to say that there's a cause for creation, that's kind of interesting because we...
What is the cause then exactly?
There isn't exactly a cause because the creation is beginningless, cyclically beginningless. So there's not a cause in that sense. There's just the reality of what is there. Brahman, which is free of any type of change or free of time, free of past, present, and future, free of parts, it's not going to cause anything because it's only just non-dual conscious being.
Right.
But non-dual conscious being has maya as an incidental attribute. Swami just says incidental attribute, which means that this maya in no way can touch or change Brahman, but it also doesn't belong anywhere else because there is nothing else but Brahman. And this maya... Brahman is changeless and beginningless, free of time. Maya is an incidental attribute of Brahman, so it also is never not there, because there's nothing to create it. Right, so it either is or it isn't. So Brahman's not going to create it, because Brahman has no parts to create anything, and there's no second thing. And so Maya is considered a beginningless, incidental attribute of timeless Brahman. And so... that creation, that maya is said to be create, to manifest as the creation cyclically, kind of like breathing. Why? The why idea doesn't, can't come into play here. Because there's no prior condition, or there's nobody making a decision. It's not like Ishwara himself doesn't have a prior condition. You know? People say, well, why did Ishwara do it this way? He could have done it a little better, you know. But this is Ishwara. It's not that Ishwara made a decision. This is beginningless. Ishwara is beginningless. There's no first time. There's no decision here. There's just the reality of what is. We want decisions. But decisions exist within duality, not outside of duality.
Does Advaita offer any suggestions in dealing with these deep-rooted vasanas or these deep-rooted desires that seem to come out of the prarabdha karma, really? I seem like they are coming out of the prarabdha
karma. Well, if they're part of that prarabdha karma, you can just go with it. It's not a problem. Because the prarabdha karma is going to manifest either... You know, in terms of your own coming out as your own desire, or you're going to be from somebody else's desire, pull you into it, or the universe just gets you into that situation. Those things aren't really a problem. A desire is not even a problem.
Yeah.
What makes a desire a problem is that it's, I want this so that I can be happy.
Yeah.
If that part's not there, then the I want this, that's an energy that's impelling you into action. There's nothing wrong with that. You have a physical body, you have prarabdha karma, there's no way that you're not going to be acting and doing things.
But it can still create a rajas imbalance, right?
Well, it depends on if you're...
Kind of a rajas dominance.
It can, but the thing is to the degree that you gain nishta in your knowledge, the source of the ananda is yourself. That's just the truth of it. In all situations, the ananda is is its source is only your being. And so your mind gets used to that reality. And then enjoying the fullness of yourself, having that home base, then it pursues this and pursues that, depending on the power of the karma, the karmas that are caused you to take this birth in the first place. That's what impels you into this direction or that direction, as opposed to a myriad of other directions you could be impelled to, but you're not. Yeah. We tend to take things too seriously sometimes. That gets us into trouble. You know, take your desires too seriously. Sort of kind of relaxing and saying, it's interesting to have this desire. Let's see what comes of it. Who cares, really, in terms of your own wholeness? Mm-hmm. You can be more interested. You know, this desire is there, this pravritti is there. I want to do this, I want to do that. That's interesting. Where did I pick that up? Is that my karma? Did I pick it up somewhere? What's that all about? Because there's nothing inside that thinks that, oh, my Anna, I need this in order for me to be a whole, complete being. I have to have this. That's not there. And yet you have these, you're impelled to do this, you're impelled to do that. It's an interesting thing.
No, it's interesting also that sattva seems to kind of lean more towards, obviously, towards dharma, and tamas more towards adharma, right? Can one look at this as a polarity? But no, because what happens with rajas? Rajas could tend to can go either way, or
all of them can go either way. In fact, a verse coming up is that just that.
But sattva can't go adharmic, or can go.
Don't equate it with adharma.
Yeah, right.
You know,
but you can also. I also have heard before, like that you can almost, if you're so too sattvic, you fall a little asleep at the wheel. You know, like a little bit
proud.
No, did you almost you're so sattvic in a way that you're kind of pretty satisfied, but it's still limited. No, but complacent in a way, but you don't go any further. You know, your life is pretty good.
Yeah.
But you might not really understand who you are ultimately.
You're not going to understand who you are until you gain knowledge, but that sattva can make you a mumukshu, or the sattva maybe can fall into tamas.
Mm-hmm.
You know what they say in meditation, this is just in part of the tradition for years, when you're meditating, there are certain obstructions. One is that you can fall asleep,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there's a similarity. Your mind becomes very quiet, you know, and that's what the mind is used to doing when it falls asleep. So in this quiet mind, it just falls back into tamas,
mm-hmm.
right? So that kind of reminds me of what you're saying.
Yeah.
Another is, so that's one, falling nidra, this falling asleep. Another is vikshepa, which is rajas, means the mind becomes kind of agitated, too many thoughts, it's just restless, becomes vikshepa, restless. The third one is kashaya, which is interesting. Kashaya are those things that rise up from the unconscious for no reason. You know, like you're meditating and these weird thoughts are coming up, emotions, feelings are coming up, those are kashayas, they acknowledge those.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is sattva itself, where there's an ananda vritti in the absorption, and then that makes your mind start thinking, oh, this is so nice. So you get sidetracked by the ananda.
Mm-hmm.
But also you could maybe mistake sattva as ananda, because it's so comfortable and pleasant in a way, but it's not really, you know.
It's not the ananda of the sattva vritti. Is a little different than its source, the ananda.
Mm-hmm.
Because the ananda never comes and goes.
Right.
So the sattva is a state of mind that reflects ananda, but it's different than the ananda, because the ananda is present in every vritti, in every experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the very core of your being. But then when the mind is quiet, it reflects the core of your being in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's comfortable to us.
I think it can be a confusion at times. At least
it's very confusing.
Especially meditation.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's one of the main confusions in understanding, really understanding Vedanta.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're always looking for a sattva vritti.
Mm-hmm.
the having the sattva as an experience, mental experience, rather than recognizing the ananda that's ever present. No matter what the experience is, that wholeness of your being is always there as the self of the experience.
What did you say were the kashayas?
Kashayas are, they're like thoughts rising up from the unconscious that really have nothing to do with the present.
I see. Distractions, basically.
They
act like that.
Well, you don't know what's generating them because there's nothing in the immediate environment that would cause those kind of thoughts to come up or those emotions to come up.
Right.
So we just say, for us, we'd say that's just the unconscious releasing.
It's endless, seems to be.
What?
It seems endless.
I don't actually think, in one sense it's endless, but in another it's not endless, because the ones that are really problematic, you do reach the bottom of the barrel. But then there's still the unconscious, which is a huge, vast ocean. You know, but then there's things if we're a jiva that are problematic, and those things do release, and you do get to the bottom of the barrel.
Uh-huh. I'm wondering if you. It seems like with sattva, rajas, and tamas that when we're acting in ways that might be associated with one of those, that there's probably a part of our brain that's more active, and a different part of the brain specific to each one, like the sattva would be the prefrontal cortex, tamas maybe the hippocampus, rajas, I don't know the name of it, but the whatever, you know, the motivational system, the dopaminergic system.
I know what you're saying, but I don't have enough knowledge about
those.
Mm-hmm. I think that all states and all experiences and all capacities have a subtle and physical counterpart. So say you're having very sattvic mind. You could probably, if you were hooked up to electrodes, could kind of find out what's going on with the brain at that time, or you're very rajasic. You could be hooked up to electrodes and kind of map it out and see how the brain responds, is responding when you're in that state.
Or like an MRI, you could...
Exactly.
Yeah.
But maybe
people do those kind of studies.
It might not be... One might not be able to localize it, actually.
You might not be able to, but people try.
Yeah,
they do experiments like that. Oh, yeah, they do.
Yeah.
They even hooked up the Dalai Lama and different meditators and things like that.
Yeah.
But where are you going to find sattva, right? I mean, it's like, it could be everywhere.
In a sattvic state, a certain part of the brain becomes active, and you can see that from the picture.
Sure.
That's all the trends.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. We're done. Mm-hmm. Are we done?
Yeah.
Yeah. We should probably bring that big thing.
Yeah. Two of you big guys can do it for us.
Yeah.